to the third case of the day, the estate of Sims versus the County of Bureau.
Thank you, Judge Long. This is a substantive due process case. The issue in the appeal is whether a reckless homicide or its tortious equivalent by a state actor is a deprivation of the substantive due process rights of the victim. The district court held this case was governed by DeShaney versus Wisconsin, the rule that a state actor has no duty, affirmative duty, to protect citizens against the conduct of third persons. That is misplaced in that the conduct involved here is not a duty to protect against the actions of third persons, but rather it is the state actor's negative duty, as this court used in DeShaney and its progeny, to refrain from certain acts. As the court, Judge Posner, had said, the Constitution is a doctrine of, is a charter of negative liberties. And this is precisely, in this case, what is alleged in a fair reading of the complaint. The facts are that the deceased was a reporter investigating a story of potential malfeasance against the sheriff. The sheriff certainly distributed on, at this stage we can say he prepared or distributed letters which the complaint referred to as obscene, defamatory, and false, accusing him of criminal conduct. There was a grand jury going on when the complaint was prepared and all the proceedings were below, so we didn't have the investigation. We now know that the allegations were that her husband was a serial child molester. The sheriff, this is a small Princeton, Illinois, Bureau County, as I've talked in the brief, and the court can take judicial notice, is a small community, very nice small town. Tiscawall, where the deceased lived, is an even smaller town of about 700. The mailings were to the entire people in Tiscawall. The sheriff, while using his badge on duty, called the dispatcher, goes out, shows the deceased the letter, and she has a heart attack. Now, the question, first question, I think the district court is misplaced entirely, and even looking at it is shady. I mean, this is Monroe versus Pape. We have a reckless homicide. Illinois calls it involuntary manslaughter, where it's tortious equivalent. Again, I say we wouldn't have to prove a crime in this case, but we've alleged close to the crime or the essence of it. I mean, this is exactly what the Ku Klux Klan was doing in the South when they passed the 14th Amendment during Reconstruction, and the Ku Klux Klan Act, as we now, the Civil Rights of Act of 1871, was passed. So historically, I mean, substantive due process, the concerns that were raised in Sacramento versus Lewis by Justice Scalia and as voiced by the court, and Justice Souter in his majority opinion over open-endedness of the doctrine, this is clearly rooted in Anglo-American law. It was the very, very purpose of the Reconstruction Amendment. So it clearly stated a claim for substantive due process under that. The court has refined the analysis in Lewis, Sacramento versus Lewis. The case, if you want to proceed on Sacramento versus Lewis and just not rest on Monroe versus Pate, the case clearly meets the Sacramento versus Lewis test. You read the complaint, it alleges intentional conduct. It did not use the exact magic words intentional, but of course this is the pleading stage. It used willful and wanton and reckless. willful and wanton and reckless, this court's decisions recognize, includes the term intentional. So certainly at the pleading stage, especially in a case like this where a grand jury was proceeding and denied any discovery or investigation, the merits of the plaintiff's claim is not determined by such word games. The first part of the Sacramento versus Lewis analysis is, if the government, governmental, the state actor's behavior is intentional, unrelated to any legitimate law enforcement goal. Well, of course, the color of state law element, the law enforcement officer is always going to be using the badge, but what was the legitimate law enforcement goal in going out here to show this woman this letter? The allegations are, and I think we can prove that beyond a doubt, even a reasonable doubt, that this husband of six daughters and a 55-year-old wife who had never had any criminal activity, he wasn't a child molester, so it was a pretext. This court has held, of course, police torture of suspects, all those sort of things. While they're under a color of state law, they're certainly within exactly why we have the 14th Amendment guarantees in the Civil Rights Act. The second part of it, if you look at it from the deliberate indifference standard under Sacramento versus Lewis, it's a little more touchy analysis. My good friend, the Sheriff's Counsel, says that the 14th Amendment is not a font of tort law, and I certainly agree with that, but tort law isn't irrelevant. You view it on a sliding scale of tort law's culpability spectrum, and clearly in this case we're not claiming negligence or anything close to it. It's deliberate indifference, reckless conduct, which certainly the sheriff himself asserted the
defense. Johnson were prosecuted for a crime under state law based on the conduct you allege. What would that crime be?
Involuntary manslaughter, Your Honor.
And why?
Reckless act, which he has reason to know would cause substantial injury.
Well, do you, and you're prepared to prove, you think that he had reason to know that this would cause injury to your...
Well, yes. Well, yes. That, of course, that's a question of proximate cause. Ultimately, they see the letter. The jury determines that. The complaint...
Well, the jury doesn't determine it without some evidence. What evidence are you planning to offer to show that he...
Well, one, the emergency room physician who testified that's what happened, that this caused an extreme flight or fear reaction.
Post. Reason to know is ex ante.
Well, yes, but again, what was his very purpose in showing this letter but to cause her distress? Of course.
Extortion differs from involuntary or voluntary or any other form of homicide.
And ultimately, in the evidence shaking out, I may not succeed on that theory, but on the deliberate indifference standard, we look under Lewis,
I think that you're not arguing, however, that it is homicide, manslaughter, or any other crime if during the course of extortion the victim happens to die.
I had not thought about that, Your Honor, I'll be honest with you at this stage. Felony murder rule.
You know, felony murder, it would be unusual if the jurisdiction treated the felony murder doctrine as applicable to nonviolent offenses. Extortion or embezzlement or things like that.
It could be. I look at it this way. I can give you a rather far-fetched example I thought of yesterday. Is assume that the sheriff goes out there with a posse of Ku Klux Klansmen in their white robes and the person dies of a heart attack. I think clearly that violates substantive due process. You raise an interesting, Judge Easterbrook, an interesting...
It's not at all clear. And I don't know why you say substantive. The Constitution says no person shall be deprived of life without due process of law. And depriving somebody of life by scaring them out of their wits is not normally a due process of law. But the problem is that you seem to have in mind some kind of layperson's medical intuition that extortion causes heart attacks. And is there any medical basis for that?
Well,
alone for the belief that people should know that extortion causes heart attacks?
Well, again, this is the pleading stage. You have as good as we can get at this stage the The
it's not as good as you can get at this stage. You could actually look at the medical literature. You could have had a medical specialist try to analyze this question.
On the pleadings, Your Honor? On a motion to dismiss with no discovery? I mean, that
you
only...
You don't need discovery to look at the medical literature or to engage your own expert.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, but I also, under all this court's rulings on the complaint, it apparently, as you use Your Honor's own words, limbs the claim, and we get into all this later. I mean, that's a summary judgment issue you're raising here, Your Honor, not a pleading issue.
What the Supreme Court keeps saying that when somebody is sued for conduct performed as a public servant, litigation should be ended as quickly as possible, usually on grounds of immunity. And the suggestion you're making now, which is, let's just forget about that, postpone the litigation, start asking these important questions years later, is not consistent with the Supreme Court's view. Now, maybe it's enough that this has not been put in issue, but I'm kind of surprised that you don't have a theory or any evidence about causation, because that's going to be the core. I would not ordinarily believe that extortion causes heart attacks. Now, maybe there's some medical evidence to the contrary. If you can't show that, all you've got is a DeShaney case.
Well, Your Honor, I'll say this to you. I think I can, based on my general knowledge of the medical literature of heart attacks, that an extreme shock extortion, which will be an extreme shock to this 55-year-old woman, could do that. But again, this wasn't resolved on qualified immunity. If it had been a motion for summary judgment, we could have come in with this evidence. You're also ignoring in Lewis the second amount of the Lewis test is, if you're relying on deliberate indifference, the question is whether the conduct of the state actor was the act, whether he had a chance to make unhurried judgment. The classic situations of the car chase in Sacramento versus Lewis or the prison riot are one where he doesn't. Now here he had an hour, 2 hours. This was clearly planned in the sense that the letters were placed in the mail, he radios, he goes out. It took at least an hour or 2 hours. I have to disagree with your interpretation because you're ignoring the second part of the Lewis versus Sacramento test that says where there is deliberate indifference, and then you look at it as to whether the time he had for judgment, and in this case, clearly the sheriff had ample time to make an unhurried judgment. It was certainly more time than the case where this court has held sufficient to state a claim for violation of substantive due process, where the prison supervisor assures the prison guard, oh, it's not dangerous, go in there, and orders him to go in there. And the prison guard does, and is injured by these dangerous prisoners. So, given that case, interpreting with no new Supreme Court precedents, it is certainly a much greater time of unhurried judgment beyond the issue you state on the first prong of the intentional whether extortion can cause a person's heart attack.
And wouldn't it be better to just go on and say he put her in a condition of danger and rather than...
Precisely. The second one there, certainly he did. The interesting question you could ask, which is not this case, well, if you're serving a writ, he prepared the letter or certainly distributed it. It's factually disputed at this stage. You're right. It gets the second DeShaney test. I agree entirely, Your Honor. He placed this letter in front of her, put her in danger. He denied her rescue. The tougher question, which isn't in this case, is, well, what if he's just serving a writ or a divorce summons or something like that? Would he have a duty to do something? In this case, having prepared this letter, which he certainly had to notice that might cause distress, put her in distress, denied her access to the telephone, and himself, the substantive due process.
He knows he puts her in distress under that theory, Mr. Stegall, because of his knowledge of her heart condition. Is that how?
Yes.
Is that the record?
Yes. The heart condition and accusing one's lifelong spouse of being a serial child molester. Applying when
he wasn't her lifelong spouse. That implies that this was a child marriage.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Adult life. Long marriage.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Mr. Kearney.
If I didn't misunderstand plaintiff's counsel, I thought I heard him say that this case is not a DeShaney case, and that he's relying solely upon...
He shifted ultimately to DeShaney as to putting someone in danger after asking.
In response to your question, that's true, Your Honor, but I would just submit that simply putting someone in danger is not sufficient to give rise to a constitutional obligation. There has to be some constitutionally culpable conduct in placing one in danger in the first instance. I mean, as a hypothetical, if Johnson went here on a legitimate, with a legitimate...
Well, he alleged it was not legitimate. He alleged a number of things concerning the letter and so forth.
I understand that, Your Honor.
Constitutionally culpable. Suppose the sheriff, in the course of driving, just drives negligently. You know, negligent driving doesn't violate the Constitution. Has an auto accident. He observes the person in the other car lying in the car, swipes her cell phone, prevents her from calling for help herself, and chortles while she dies. Any problem?
Yes, because I think the culpable conduct is not the conduct in causing the incident in the first place. The culpable conduct is failing to rescue, is failing to provide aid to someone that...
But it's the whole point of your brief that failing to rescue somebody is just a DeShaney issue and not actionable.
That's the
case I'm giving you is a case where an injury or a problem was caused by the state official.
Yes.
But caused without violating the Constitution in any way.
I understand that. Now, but you're giving me, in your hypothetical, you are giving me facts that show a purpose and intent to aggravate an injury.
No.
That's, well, you said he swiped the phone.
Just to let it take its natural course.
Well, you said he swiped the phone.
Swiping the phone doesn't cause people to die.
Okay, in that circumstance, I would submit that may very well be a common law tort theory of recovery, where one, through fault or otherwise, and I think that's set forth in the restatement as an example of a common law theory of recovery. If you, through no fault of your own even, cause an accident, you have some obligations under the common law to provide aid to that person that you've injured. So if you let it take its course, my argument would be, Judge, there is no liability under those circumstances. You're saying simply because you negligently put someone in a, at least as I understand the question, if you negligently put someone in peril, do you have a constitutional obligation to aid? My position is no. My position is your only obligation is to refrain from engaging in conscience-shocking behavior, whether we call it County of Sacramento or not. The theories that were advanced below and as construed by the magistrate in their counts 9 and 10 are a far cry from what the plaintiff's counsel is advancing now before this court. Their theory in the court below was that the sheriff failed to protect or failed to provide medical care, went through conduct, he put her in extremis. There was no allegations in the court below that the sheriff engaged in some type of a reprehensible conduct. There's no allegation. There were no allegations.
I don't understand.
Well,
extortion is reprehensible conduct, and this complaint alleges extortion about as clearly as one can imagine.
But not that at the time. What the complaint alleges that he was in the process of investigating an issue, not that he went there to extort her. And the complaint in the court below, there was no argument advanced until we got new counsel on appeal that now my theory of liability is you went there with a purpose or intent or in engaging in conscience-shocking behavior brought about her death in the first instance, not as a failure to rescue. The allegations that they're now making that the sheriff composed the letter are nowhere contained in the complaint.
Are they reasonably inferred from the complaint?
No.
Even in any possible circumstance, the complaint might assert that?
That he composed the letter? No. That he distributed the letter, the complaint says he distributed the letter. The complaint nowhere alleges that he composed the letter. The complaint specifically alleges in the paragraphs 172 and 180 of their various respective counts, counts 9 and 10, that he went there to investigate, and he reasonably should have known that he was placing her in danger. It's our position that at least as far as the conduct which precipitated the heart attack, that conduct has to be constitutionally culpable. He has to have known that he was placing her in some peril, that he was placing her, that there was a substantial risk of injury or death.
Like, Eric, is there a reasonable or neutral construction of the distribution aspect of the letter?
Is there a
you make a distinction that it's not alleged that he drafted or created the document. And you say it only, you acknowledge that the complaint does speak of distribution.
Yes, it does.
So are you suggesting that nothing can be drawn from that allegation of distribution in a negative way?
At least the way they framed their complaint, they pled themselves out of court. They said he went there to investigate. And he should have known that based upon her prior history that there was a risk that he would induce emotional distress, that she would that would increase some physical reaction, and that she would have a heart attack. I'm not suggesting any new pleading standard. All I'm saying is, in any type of a case, whether it be a prisoner assault case or a suicide case, you require that there be allegations that we know, subjective state of mind, that we know that we are creating a substantial risk that this person is going to die. And those allegations are absent.
So the fatal flaw is not alleging that he was the draftsman.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
So a fatal flaw you're suggesting is that he was not the draftsman.
No. Without regard to whether he drafted it, if they alleged that we knew, and we had some illegitimate purpose, if we knew that in presenting her with this letter, and we had some nefarious purpose, that would cause her to have a heart attack, or that there was a substantial risk based upon facts that we knew.
Why does this have to be alleged? I mean, this sounds like a requirement of fact pleading.
No, I'm not. I'm saying, Your Honor, I'm not asking that they plead specific facts. I'm telling them, tell me that your theory is that we knew that by engaging in this conduct, we were placing our risk.
Theories and complaints either. All you have to do is say what your grievance is.
And their grievance is not that we knew that we were placing her at risk.
Not their grievance at all.
If there are no further questions, I believe I'm into my co-counsel's time.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Kaysen?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is George Kaysen. I'm representing the three government defendants that were named here. And actually, our position is that we shouldn't even be here on appeal. And I think the plaintiff recognizes and has acknowledged in their reply brief that the two of these defendants should not be here, that he has, in fact, waived any claim against them, that being the County of Bureau and the Bureau County Sheriff's Department.
I gather he's afraid if you don't stay in the case, he's not. If he recovers against the former sheriff or the sheriff, he may not be able to get money from him unless you reimburse the sheriff. Is that the situation?
Well, that's a claim that could be made after a judgment is entered. It doesn't require the continuance of the county as a party in the case. As a practical matter, the county was dismissed. The magistrate below recommended dismissal of the county, and there was no objection by the plaintiff. That recommendation, therefore, was adopted by the district court. And
you know, the Supreme Court of Illinois considered this question just 2 weeks ago.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And it said the county should remain a party.
Well, that was. It didn't say that they should remain a party. What it said was that the plaintiff, after entry of a judgment against a sheriff in his official capacity, did have the right under the Tort Immunity Act of Illinois to seek to turn to the county
to collect from the county, and it viewed the county
correct.
Obviously as a correct party when the suit was a personal capacity suit. Right. The tough question was what happens if it's strictly an official capacity suit. Here we have a personal capacity suit. And I can't imagine why the county would not want to be a party. It then wouldn't be able to control the litigation in any way. And if, back to what happened in that case, the sheriff settles the case for $1 million or $5 million, guess what? The county has to pay, and it won't have any way to protest.
Well, I agree with that.
Why do you want to be in that position? I don't understand it.
I agree with... Actually, Your Honor, I think we have the best of positions, at least in this litigation, because the plaintiff did not perfect his claim against the county below, but we continue to be a party before Your Honor for purpose of appeal, so we can make our arguments. And that's what we attempted to do in our brief. I think counsel didn't want Your Honors to review our brief, and I don't think he was successful in that effort. Your Honors, the one claim that plaintiff is attempting to pursue on appeal against one of my clients is against the sheriff in his official capacity. However, again, that is a claim that the party that should not be before the court on appeal. The claims against the sheriff in his official capacity, as pleaded in the complaint, were reviewed by the magistrate, determined that they only stated claims under state law, did not state federal claims, and that as a party, he was the sheriff in his official capacity was redundant because the plaintiff had also named the sheriff's department. Therefore, the magistrate recommended that the sheriff in his official capacity be dismissed. Plaintiff did not object to that recommendation, and it was adopted without objection by the district court. Therefore, the sheriff in his official capacity is not before the court. One issue that I do want to address, Your Honor, that was not addressed by the other parties, is whether the sheriff was acting under color of state law if he committed what's alleged in this complaint. And we feel pretty strongly that the facts as alleged in the complaint would not meet the standard as a matter of law in order for a state officer to be found for federal civil rights purposes to be acting under color of state law. What the sheriff is alleged to have done here is not something that he was able to do solely because of his office. This allegation that he distributed a letter, or for that matter, the unpleaded allegation that he made up this letter, has nothing to do with his office or his duties or his authority as an officer. That's a purely private act.
Well, this wasn't the allegation that an inference made that he was in uniform in an official police car, showed up to make an investigation. Can't that be inferred from the pleadings?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It's not something that's stated anywhere in the pleadings. If you can affirm that, you can infer that he wasn't in his police car, that he was driving.
We have to take the inferences in favor of the plaintiff in this case.
Fine. Even if you infer that, the fact that he's in uniform or in a police car is not itself determinant of whether or not he's acting under color of state law. I mean, that's really one circumstance, and the courts consider the totality of circumstances. In fact, what car he drove to that house, what he was wearing at that time, is totally peripheral to what actually happened. The claims, the key claims are that he wrote this letter and that he showed it to her for purposes, as the judge says, of extortion. Those are private acts. Those are not acts that were made possible because of his authority as sheriff.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Mr. Spiegel?
Thank you, Your Honor. I should refer, for the court's help, paragraph 37 of the complaint, page 8, does allege that the administrator, again, we were limited in the grand jury investigation, received information from an informant that stated he stuffed the letters for Craig Johnson. That certainly could be interpreted on a liberal sense at this stage, given the limitations that Johnson prepared them or ordered someone else to prepare them.
Well, that could speak to distribution, though, too.
Yeah, it could, too. But ambiguity, that's as Judge Kaney stopped his, are resolved in our favor. And later, I stated in his brief, we did obtain a copy of that testimony, and he said he was ordered to help him, and he prepared it. Whether Johnson himself prepared the letter or had someone prepare it for him and then distribute it is really a distinction without a difference. If he had somebody who was a better writer or a typer or some typist. Also, the question about the...
Is your position that the allegation of his being the draftsman wasn't there or because at the point of drafting you didn't, the complaint, you weren't possessed of that information?
Yes, we're not sure. At this point, the final point I would make is that Magistrate Judge Evans certainly found in his order sustaining the substantive due process claims that he read the allegations as being a sham investigation. So certainly the district court did. We're entitled to the magistrate.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Thank you, Ms. Koenig, Captain. The case is taken under advisement.